It's 8:09. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with Summit County Economic Development Director Jeff Jones. We'll be talking a little bit about the census as well as affordable housing prices and what makes affordable. Utah Open Lands Executive Director Wendy Fisher answers questions about the Boyert Tech Park open space as well as the lack of a conservation easement there, as well as the organization's 30th anniversary. Park City Public Works Manager Troy Daly with details on the park city pavement plan as well as the Park Avenue slurry project. Representatives of Park City Rotary, who met yesterday to hand out their Professional Citizen of the Year award, said the choice for this honor the year, the choice for the honor this year was obvious. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports the award went to Summit County Health Director Rich Bullough, who has guided the county through the COVID-19 pandemic for the last 6 months.
Bullo received the Linda Singer Barrett Professional Citizen Award, named after Park City Rotary's first female president. The audience that honored Bullo gathered in Rotary Park, one of the few times the club has met in person since the coronavirus outbreak. The attendees wore masks and maintained social distancing, and the microphone at the dais was wiped down between speakers. Sally Elliott, a member of the Summit County Council when Bullo was hired in 2010, said that upwards of 16 Rotarians nominated him for this year's honor. The speakers often noted that Bullo has taken it on the chin as the guy who has delivered bad news and announced restrictions during the crisis. County Sheriff Justin Martinez was one of those who nominated Bullo, but he started out with a few roast-style remarks for the health director.
Rich has obviously imposed a lot of orders in Summit County. He has actually crippled Summit County. He has closed businesses. He has forced us to wear masks. He has forced us into a position where we no longer can operate and function as normal human beings. This is an example of that. And yet he has the audacity to ask me to say something nice about him. So we're going to go down that road, Rich.
On a more serious note, the sheriff said that Bullo has saved countless lives and has been a leader.
He was the first person in the state of Utah to put orders out. Orders that I'm supposed to enforce, but he put these orders out when no one else was willing to do that. And that takes a true leader, Rich. That takes somebody who's willing to step out in front and be the tip of the spear. You are that tip of the spear. And what Rich did, everybody else in the state stood back and watched to see what this crazy man's ideas were going to come. Is the county going to revolt? Are people going to have issues? And when the rest of the state realized and other counties realized that, no, we need leadership. We want guidance. We want to know what we should and shouldn't do. The governor's office took Rich's orders and basically carbon copied them and put the state of Utah logo on it. And so because of that, because of the order he's put here in Summit County, he has indirectly saved lives in the entire state of Utah.
The sheriff added that Bullo has kept his wits about him and did not make decisions dictated by politics. County Attorney Margaret Olson said that COVID aside, Bullo also enabled the county to make significant improvements in its behavioral health responses. Bullo thanked the audience for the award, but not before checking with Rotarian Bob Richard to see if the mic had been wiped.
I don't quite know what to say, although, did this get cleaned?
Major screw-up.
About 2 weeks before COVID hit, you might remember I spoke to Rotary. Some of you were there. I got this out and cleaned the microphone before I did that. We now have Bob Richard cleaning the microphone. That shows you how far we've come.
I'm a germaphobe.
He said that he and County PIO Derek Sitaway are aware that he gets beat up a lot.
In fact, I was going to read an introduction from Derek that basically said this is the tagline for the press release, and that is that the communistic deep state health director is getting an award for closing the economy. And that kind of sums it up. But the fact is, I haven't had to play the same political battles here that many of my colleagues have, because we have support of the community.
Bullo said he had a long list of people to thank, including county council, colleagues led by County Manager Tom Fisher, local city governments, in particular Park City, the Park City Medical Center, local law enforcement, school superintendents, business, the overall community, and his wife, Kirsten Whetstone, and son, Garrett, who have had to put up with a lot of BS and pressure, as he put it. He said the crisis has brought a focus to the profession he's worked in for decades.
Public health is a lot bigger than COVID. And, you know, unfortunately, it took a pandemic to shine a light on it because we work in the background. But I think our interests in many ways are similar to yours. We want a healthy, safe community where people can thrive. And it's important for us to have leadership like we have here to share that story.
Rotary's Professional Citizen of the Year, Rich Bullough. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
Well, the deadline for census reporting coming up, and there have been recent discussions on affordable housing and how affordable is it? On the phone with some details on both topics, I have Summit County Economic Development Director Jeffrey Jones. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So with about an 80% response rate in Utah census, Census Bureau started knocking on doors here in Utah. What is the response rate for here in Summit County?
Okay, well, the self-response rate for the state of Utah, I believe, is around 68.5%. That's where it was on Monday. And for Summit County, it was 39.1%. And Park City, it was 24.3%. Camas City was 55.4%. Oakley City was 46.8%. Francistown was 69.3%. Colville City was 53.2%. And Hennepin Town was 66.2%. And so with the enumerators that began their work last week, normally you could look to see those numbers improve 10 to 12% on top of the self-response rates. So we're hoping we get, you know, a higher number. The census is extremely important to us. Over 300 federal programs rely on census data to allocate funds geographically, as do numerous state and local initiatives.
Yeah. So, I mean, Park City, that means like one out of every four households has not responded?
On the self-response rate, but one thing to keep in mind is that even in 2010, the self-response rate coming out of Park City was only 13.2%. So at 24.3%, their self-response rate is actually higher than it was in 2010, although the overall rate, if I go and look back at my chart, I believe they were in the 60% range because of the work from the enumerators that were done. They were actually 67% for a final census total in 2010. So they're doing better on the self-response rates, but this was the first year that, you know, we've gone to an online process. So it's going to be interesting to see how well that works out. A lot of people in Park City, including myself, have PO boxes. And so unlike, census notifications were not sent to PO boxes. And so that could be one of the problems that people are experiencing in being able to making sure that they are properly counted.
Are these numbers good enough?
Well, I'd love to see 100%. I mean, for every person who doesn't complete the census, then we lose approximately $1,880 per person. And when I put that on a household basis within Summit County, then it's over $5,000 per household that we could potentially lose. And we lose those dollars every year for 10 years. So the magnitude of that can be, you know, can be particularly challenging. But the numbers that you're citing, you know, that the lower response rates, we are doing, you know, a little better than some of our resort market peers as well. When I look at like Pitkin County, Colorado, they're at 35.9, Eagle County, Colorado at 35.8. Summit County, Colorado, 26.7. Teton County, Wyoming, 32.3. So resort communities have just traditionally been challenged with regards to self-response rates on census.
Yeah. So we do have census takers in Summit County now following up?
We do.
Yeah. And how's that going? Again, a lot of people, just given the whole COVID situation, just don't answer doors.
That's, you know, I think it's probably challenging to those folks. And there has been one post that I saw on social media where a census worker was not wearing a mask and knocked on somebody's door, and people were taken back by that. Once that information was conveyed to me, then I conveyed that information back to the regional office in Orem, and they said that that was extremely important to them, that the census enumerators wear their masks when they are knocking on doors and making contact with people.
All right. So they do leave something at the door so somebody could follow up online then?
That is correct.
Yeah. So it's still not too late for people to go on and do this themselves, but time is running out. The deadline was moved up a month. How come?
Yeah, that's really a curious one for us. In light of the pandemic, the original deadline was moved to the end of October, and then it was changed to the end of September. And I'm not sure what the reasoning was behind that, but it means that we have 30 plus days to try to get our numbers up. And so I hope that anybody that's listening to this broadcast this morning will take the time to sit down and take the census. It only takes, literally, you can complete it in about 5 minutes.
Yeah. And there was a lot of concern early on about whether or not somebody had to note whether or not they were a citizen of the U.S. Now it's just they just want live bodies. That's all that matters.
That's correct. We're just trying to get an accurate population count.
Yeah. And then what do you do with the data?
Well, census data is distributed through, like I mentioned earlier, a variety of programs, and that it can impact our emergency services. It can impact our health department, and the fact that we're in a pandemic should at least provide some motivation for people to return the census, because those dollars are definitely getting used. For me personally, I use the census in a lot of my economic models. The census provides much of the baseline information for every economic input-output model, and it helps us with regards to land use planning, where we're growing. It helps with regards to transportation planning and funding. So it plays a major role in the lives of government.
Yeah. So the money that county received then from the CARES Act, was based on the 2010 census?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I believe that you are correct in that the allocation was based on population of each state. And so the census probably played a significant role in that.
Okay. People can check out, I believe it's my2020census.gov.
That is correct.
Okay. People want to fill that out. It takes all of about 5 minutes. There's been some discussion on the Dakota Pacific project. We've got an applicant saying that they are building affordable housing. We've got others who say that the housing that is going to be built there isn't going to be affordable for those who are supposed to live there. And apparently you have done some research when it comes to affordable housing and what is affordable.
Well, all, larger counties and larger cities within Utah are required to prepare annually what is called the moderate income housing plan. And the moderate income housing plan takes into, you're asked to review what your ability are to serve populations that are 80% of the area median income or less. The due date for all of the moderate income housing plans is December 1st. And so I'm in the process of preparing the moderate income housing plan for this year. And I'm sure Park City and Camas and some of the other smaller jurisdictions are also in the process of updating their moderate income housing plan. With regards to what is affordable, then you have to look at specific occupation data and look at, okay, here's the median earnings per job based on occupation data, and then factor in 30% of those earnings being allocated to housing or less. And so that stratification, you know, our greatest need, of course, will be at the lower portion of the triangle from the perspective that usually those that are 30 to 50% AMI we're going to have a much bigger need there than the 50 to 80, the 80 to 100, and the 80 to 120, or the 100 to 120. Yeah. And those are also the hardest group to finance in order to make housing affordable to those particular AMI targets.
Right. So what is the current AMI in Summit County?
The current Summit County AMI is for a family of four is $113,900.
So if 80% of that, we're looking at about $91,000 for a family of four. I mean, realistically, is that what a service industry family is earning?
Probably not. But, you know, once again, it kind of depends. Like when you look at household structure, you know, you have to look at, you know, one individual may work in the service industry and another individual may work in a professional technical service job where it brings the overall household income up. So we will, as part of the moderate income housing plan, we look at those things where we divide up the number of households by income stratification. And you can, if you go on to the Summit County Economic Development webpage, you'll see a study that was completed by Jim Wood. And Jim has done that for us. I believe the study was prepared in May of 2019. And you can read through that study and you can see where the number of households are with regards to income stratification. And as far as the overall need goes, when that study was prepared, it showed that we had a combined need of rental and ownership product of 400 plus units of housing, of workforce and affordable housing over a period of 5 years. So that would be roughly 2,000 plus units that we have a need for. And, you know, I think in the last 5 years, we've only had a few projects that have actually been completed and out of the ground. I think the Woodward has 8 units. Richard Place, I think, had 25 units. And Discovery had 30 units. So we're a lot of units short of where we need to be based on the assessment that was completed in 2019.
Yeah. What about those 1,100 beds there at the base of the canyons?
The 1,100 beds at the canyons, that actually equates to 169 units. That project, we're looking forward to them breaking ground and completing that project, but that hasn't happened yet. So we really don't count those projects until they're actually constructed as meeting a particular need.
Okay. So this moderate income housing plan, does this then help determine, again, when we have developers coming in with affordable housing plans, does that then kind of determine whether or not this is housing that is going to be used by those living there and working there? Because I think that's part of this concern is that we're building housing and we're just building more of the same. I mean, we've got housing that people who work as maids and as custodians and as you know, kind of this lower income bracket, that they're not going to be able to live where this housing is being built.
Well, I think the Modern Income Housing Plan can help us provide data around being able to serve those populations. And then I'm a huge fan of the low-income housing tax credit programs because if you access the LIHTC tax credits, then you have to suppress rents for your project below 60% AMI. And so that really helps our service industry employees. And you can certainly see that on the existing tax credit projects that we have in place, like Richard Place and the Junction. Those are the projects that really help our service industries.
Right. I mean, and that's the projects that's being done by Mountainlands Community Housing or Habitat for Humanity, not by private developers, or am I wrong there?
No, actually, private developers also do utilize low-income housing tax credits as well. So like Liberty Peak Apartments that were built as part of the original Boyer Tech Park project, that's owned by, I believe, Cowboy Partners, which is a private development firm. But it's also a low-income housing tax credit project, and there's 150-plus units there.
So as we consider, I guess, new development projects, I mean, that equation that has to be figured into this, yeah?
I think so. I believe that, you know, and of course, the tax credits are not automatic. They're competitive. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's the challenge that developers face, is that there's a couple of different types of credits. There's a 9% credit, a 4% credit. And the 9% credits are the credits that are going to give the developer the ability to push rents down to even the 30 to 50% AMI target in some cases, whereas the 50%, the 4% credit isn't going to be able to allow them usually to get that deep into the subsidy because the level of equity they get from the credit isn't as great.
So are you appearing then at Snyder Basin and Eastside Planning Commission meetings, you know, to give your input when we're hearing about development projects with, quote, affordable housing?
I've been participating in the Planning Commission, and I prepared an analysis with regards to whether or not the proposal by Dakota Pacific met the overall requirement of the inclusionary zoning within Summit County's development code. And so when I analyzed that, then it, you know, that project met the requirement for both the number of units and number of affordable unit equivalents as well.
Okay, at a price that people can afford.
Well, at the way the code is written, is our code is below, is 80% AMI or below. So the final allocation of those units within that stratification is something that would be decided later. But the affordable units below 80% AMI, then they would definitely meet that.
Okay. Hey, I've got to leave it there. Jeff, anything else you wanted to mention?
Just that we've been busy with our distributing CARES Act grant funding, and there's been a huge response to that. We released a grant on Monday for both nonprofits in the amount of $100,000 and for small business in the amount of $300,000. The $300,000 grant was oversubscribed by $300,000 on day one. So lots of our small business people are still challenged by current conditions.
Okay. Hey, Jeff Jones, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Jeff Jones is the Economic Development Director for Summit. Well, as we've reported, the 304 acres of open space, part of a $25 million open space acquisition by Park City and Summit County years ago, remains without a conservation easement on it. Instead, a deed restriction was recorded for this property 2 years after the property was bought. On the phone with a bit of history with this parcel, I have the Executive Director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So we're talking about the Boyer property, formerly known as the PRI, Property Reserve, Inc. property. Again, half of it was used to for the Boyer Tech Park. Again, the other 300 acres or so was purchased, again, as part of a deal with PRI for property there as well as in Round Valley. Can you tell us start us off here by, do you know why the property doesn't have a conservation easement on it?
Well, I know that there's been some chatter out there on social media and whatnot about the fact that Utah Open Lands holds the conservation easement on that property, and we don't. I don't know the specific reason that it doesn't have a conservation easement. Utah Open Lands was asked by the Basin Open Space Advisory Council to work on a conservation easement. We worked on the baseline documentation, had a subcommittee of the BOZAC committee, and looked at all sorts of issues with respect to the property and what an eventual conservation easement would look like. But I don't know why there isn't a conservation easement on it. But I appreciate being able to let people know, no, we don't have a conservation easement on it.
Yeah, so there is a deed restriction, again, recorded November 2010. The property closed on November 2008. I guess, we're just kind of curious why something like that would take so long. I mean, was that when you were doing the work as they were kind of considering a conservation easement?
Well, I don't know why the deed restriction got recorded, in that fashion. And again, the conservation easement, I mean, we did the diligence on it. We found actually a species on the property that is listed as a sensitive species by the Division of Wildlife Resources. We looked at everything from if there was the Olympics again, could the conservation easement take into account, Olympic parking. We looked at some of the traffic congestion issues and if there was going to be an issue with Landmark Drive. We looked at trails and wetlands, and we even looked at the potential of a green cemetery. All of those things were things that were considered important by the Basin Open Space Advisory Committee subcommittee that had been tasked to work with Utah Open Lands on putting that together. We did the work.
Mm-hmm. It just never got followed through then. I mean, guess so a conservation easement, is it that flexible? I mean, it could allow for a parking lot during the Olympics?
One of the things that we had considered is if that was something that was of interest to folks and they wanted to do that, that maybe that became a part of the property that didn't have a conservation easement on it. We looked at all sorts of different ways to try and accommodate that. It was done on that property before, and it was something that they worked through with the Army Corps of Engineers. So it was certainly was something that the committee was tasked with, looking at all of those different issues to determine what the best conservation easement could be to ensure that the future uses that they wanted to see would happen. Again, I think as you mentioned in your introduction, the property was purchased through the open space bonds. Obviously, there was also the 100 acres in the Round Valley area that was part of that negotiation as well. But that was, sort of typically what we had all been doing was placing conservation easements on land that had been purchased through those open space bonds.
So what is the difference between a conservation easement and a deed restriction?
Well, one of the fundamental differences between a conservation easement and a deed restriction is that there are restrictions on who qualifies as the entity that can hold a conservation easement under both the federal guidelines and the state statute. So, it has to be a qualifying entity like a land trust, like Utah Open Lands. It can also be a government entity, but it can't just be any private party that holds the conservation easement. And that is considered a qualifying conservation organization under those regulations. So that, I think, is one of the fundamental differences. The other element to a conservation easement, even if you're not doing a tax deduction, these documents are done in perpetuity. And the other thing that I think is really important is there's also a nexus with the charitable trust doctrine. In other words, there's an intent behind folks that have donated to help save a piece of property and ensure that it is not developed in perpetuity. So those are basically the underpinnings of the conservation easement. As I'm not an attorney, but as I understand it, with a deed restriction, that's more along the lines of kind of a contract between two parties.
So can a deed restriction be unrecorded so that could a conservation easement ever be placed on this property?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, a conservation easement could definitely be placed on this property. I am aware that deed restrictions, you know, change, and if the two parties get together, they can make changes, including unrecording a deed restriction.
Yeah, a lot of legal speak in the deed restriction. Paragraph 3 talks about it, about the benefited property owner. Who is that? Is that us, the people who purchased it, or is that the folks that are, the owners across the street?
Yeah, Leslie, I'd have to take a look exactly at what the deed restriction says. It's been a while since I saw that document, and I don't have it right in front of me. But, you know, as I recall, it was an agreement between the private developer, the Boyer Company, as I believe the benefited entity. Basically, what you might call the grantee is what I remembered. And I don't remember specifically, but I think there's things in the document that talk about what the benefited property was.
Yeah. So there's also a note where the Utah Olympic Park would be allowed up to 3 acres of this open space, and that's apparently where they built their employee housing. But again, I mean, if the deed restriction says that they get 3 acres, can they get more? And did they?
In that particular instance, I think that if it's a deed restriction, again, there are changes that the parties can come to and make changes, as I understand it. I believe it was Craig Arrow and Sancy Leachman, who were with CAGE, that I think brought that issue up a long time ago, and it was their impression that there wasn't 3, but it was actually 5 acres.
Yeah. Okay. Is this something that you follow up on, or it's okay as it is?
Well, certainly Utah Open Lands, and I have to admit, we're biased, right? We're a land trust. This is our 30th year of land protection. As an organization, we have seen the legislature legislate that certain lands should be protected and 10 years later decide that they want to swap that out for some development interests that have come through. And so we fought some of those fights, and we definitely think that the best protection is a conservation easement, because as you have kind of recognized in your intro, you know, this is now a piece of history that goes back, and who remembers? That's one of the reasons for having a conservation easement and having an organization that is dedicated to the land protection. So we definitely think this should have a conservation easement, but we're not the landowners. And certainly Utah Open Lands doesn't engage in forcing anybody to place a conservation easement on a piece of property. It's a voluntary program. We do think it is the best protection. That is one of the reasons that we continue to do conservation easements. And really, we feel work hand in glove with so many different agencies and landowners throughout the state to ensure the permanent protection of these landscapes. It's a hard-fought battle, as you well know. Oftentimes, lots of dollars. We've done this numerous times. As an organization, numerous times as a community. It's a hard-fought battle to get these open spaces protected from the threat of development. And so we feel the best tool to ensure that legacy and really that promise is to put a conservation easement on it.
All right. You mentioned your 30th anniversary of Utah Open Lands. Congratulations on that. And I think you have been the one and only executive director of the organization.
Like a marriage, for better or worse, right?
So I was on that city road tour to Jackson,
yes,
where we first learned about land trust. And then we started off, I mean, it was Summit Land Trust. Is that what it first started as?
So the organization started right on Prospector Avenue. My mom was in one of those first meetings when Story Clark from the Jackson Hole Land Trust came down. And I started working for Utah Open Lands, which at the time was the Summit Land Conservation Association. And we, you know, really began right there in 1990 in the heart of Park City. It was really born out of the fact that there were a lot of changes taking place in Summit County. At that time, I think there were two staff members that covered the entire planning for Summit County. And so it was looking at the changes in Park City and Summit County and deciding that one of the best ways to protect the rural mountain town character of the Park City area, what really makes this a destination, would be to ensure it through creating a land trust. At the time, there were no open space bonds. There was no statewide open space fund. You know, some people thought conservation easements were just a really odd tool. I believe the enabling legislation for conservation easements in Utah had only started 5 years prior to that. And so we were really the fledgling group on the cusp of land preservation in Utah, and a lot of people were seeking it. One of the things that I think is really interesting and that I love to look at is in the first 10 years, the first decade of the organization, we had protected close to 20,000 acres really through donations from landowners alone, utilizing the federal tax incentives, again, because there were no bonds at that time. So it really shows you the dynamic value of having a conservation easement. But yep, 30 years strong, we're really proud of all of the work that we've done.
Well, congratulations. And of course, celebrations are difficult during COVID. Any plans, though, for something?
We are doing small, socially distant, discreet backyard parties with anybody who would like to have one. We're anxious to do that. We also have an online auction that has all of the great stuff that we usually have at our annual gala, and that goes live from the 14th through the 20th of September. And we do hope people will support the good work. The general operations for this organization are the foundation for so many of the projects, like the Albert Kohler Legacy Farm in the Midway area. We still have $546,000 to raise, but we've leveraged that $7 million purchase price to just down to $546,000. So we really rely on donations to the organization to keep this good work going.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations. Wendy, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, as many of you have found out, a slurry seal project happening along Park Avenue that is scheduled to be finished today. And the phone with an update, I have Park City Public Works Manager Troy Daly. Good morning, Troy. Thanks for hanging on.
Good morning, Leslie.
So will you finish today on Park Ave?
Well, the rain that's come by the last 2 days has threatened the project, but we've been able to stay on schedule, and we should finish actually mid-morning, I'm hopeful.
Okay. And tell us what the slurry seal does.
It provides a new wear surface, essentially, over the road. As the roads, it starts out as very black, and it tends to oxidize. And the emulsion, which is some polymers, it's some oils and an aggregate, apply a thin layer over the street, and that gives a new wear surface, and it helps against the cracking, fading of the road, and extend its life.
Yeah, so quick as opposed to the rotomilling and repaving then.
Repaving and rotomilling is definitely a more intrusive project where we're removing a couple inches of old asphalt, lowering utilities, and then adding new asphalt and then readjusting the utilities. That is definitely the preferred way to go, but it's very expensive and it's intrusive too. It takes us a while to get that work done.
Okay. So what else does the rest of the summer road project schedule look like?
So this is the last of our slurry seal for the year. And then as we cool off in probably late September, we will do crack seal, and that's our last step. And we choose to do that late in the summer because the crack seal is very hot and it's applied in the cracks, and we want it to cool off as quickly as we can so we can turn the traffic back on. It's almost a rolling lane closure. We really don't don't have to close any roads for any extended period of time, just maybe a couple hundred yards, and we just move down the street. Those are various roads that we'll do throughout town, and that's more done as by the ton of product, not so much the lane mile or the amount, this road versus that road, so we do that by the ton.
Yeah, were there projects this summer scheduled that you couldn't do due to the budget cuts?
No, I think Matt and working with council and Matt, we was able to do what we planned on doing without, in much part that bids came in less than we anticipated. They came in less than we had last year. And we bid our projects out in March, April, so I think that was right in the middle of it, and I think some contractors wanted to get some work on the books, and we was able to get some good pricing. So we did get a lot of work done this summer.
Yeah. The waterline project seems to be the most disruptive. Is that you're overseeing that, or is that like the water department?
I am not. That would be Clint McAfee in the water department's project.
Okay. All right, but that's still ongoing, right?
It is. I think they're getting closer, though. They're definitely getting close.
Okay. Anything else, Troy, you wanted to update us on?
No. I'm glad we're almost finished, and we're ready for another winter to start kicking off here in the next few months.
Okay. Appreciate your time there, Troy.
Thank you.
Troy Daly, again, is the Park City Public Works Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Summit County Council meets in regular session this afternoon and will consider decisions related to budgets, tax revenues, planning, and, of course, COVID. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
The council is meeting electronically. Shortly after 3 p.m., they will hear the Snyderville Recreation District propose some changes to their budget this year. The district was slammed by the coronavirus lockdowns, and then after that, the reluctance by patrons to return to the Basin Fieldhouse. The district is proposing to cut its budget 13%. County Manager Tom Fisher said the Recreation District will defer a couple of capital and maintenance projects, but nothing major. The district is not cutting any employees, but is changing some of its plans for staffing.
They were planning on adding some staff in a couple of areas. One area they will still do that, and that's in the trails enforcement area that we've been talking a lot about lately. But there was another area in recreation that they will not add to staff members that they had projected to.
At about 4 p.m., the council will consider an amendment to county code dealing with property tax exemptions.
This is a provision that the treasurer and the assessor's office has been talking with the attorney's office for quite a long time about. Mostly, it was dealing with primary home exemptions. And changing some of the deadlines or aligning those more. There's some weird things between state law in the way that the filings have to be made in May, and yet there's some other deadlines in state law that indicate that it might be November. So the assessor is trying to clean that up so that it's a little clearer to the public about when they can make those applications.
At 4:30, the council will consider making two applications to the state's recently enacted Rural County Grant Program. The requests were recommended by their Economic Development Advisory Committee. One application is for small business grants to help out recipients on the east side that have been impacted by COVID. A second request would be for outdoor hospitality service grants, which will help businesses look for options to serve outside customers while maintaining COVID precautions. We asked Fisher, though, what opportunities local operators will have with winter coming in just a few months.
You know, there's still a few months left in our year that might allow for outdoor dining, and certainly $95,000 in grants to help with that may not go very far, but it also might help for next year. Because some of that infrastructure, if it is infrastructure, or even just allowing for permits to be applied for, the cost of a permit to be applied for, that might also help for next year.
After that, the council considers three interrelated actions that will extend the county's public health emergency order. from its current expiration date, September 1st, to January 8th of 2021. Fisher said the mandatory mask order will stay in effect. There will be no new restrictions or penalties on citizens. Meanwhile, the county is investigating a reported maskless party in Part City that correlated with a spike in COVID-19 cases. We asked Fisher why the county doesn't identify where the party took place.
The hard part about all of these types of cases is that it ends up pointing to individuals, and you know, HIPAA laws require us to not do anything to link health information to an individual. So that's one area. But in the other side of this, which is the enforcement side, this is still under investigation. And in an active investigation, we don't give out that information until the attorney's office is comfortable with that and is ready to make a determination. So those two things together are the reason. And I think the health department has put out as much information as they possibly can at this point.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Finally, the council will get an update on the Cedar Crest Village overlay proposal in Hoytsville. Council is meeting in a joint session with the East County Planning Commission. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.